Hello, this is the hardcore legend Mick Foley. I'd like to title this video WWE, We've Got a Problem, because I think you do. And that problem is that WWE is no longer the place for talent to aspire to. Part of it is because AEW is doing a great job of attracting great talent, proven talent, building other talent, creating storylines, but part of it is a problem of your own making. I think younger talent sees the way that developmental characters are cut or left by the wayside, or in the case of Karrion Kross, greatly watered down and even made a joke of when they debut on the main roster. It's not broke. Don't fix it. If I was an aspiring talent now, big league talent with a major decision to make, I'm not sure that I would trust WWE Creative to do the right thing with my career. You guys did wonders with me back in the day. That was a different time, different place. If it was today, I'm not sure I would trust the powers to be with my career in their hands. And until that changes, WWE, you've got a problem.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have 2 more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
That audio that you just heard there was posted in a video by Mick Foley to his Facebook page on Tuesday, the morning after Monday Night Raw. And it went viral. He was trending on Twitter. Everybody was sharing a link to the video. And the reason it went viral is because everything he said in that video is 100% fact. Now, I don't always agree with everything Mick Foley has to say. I don't doubt that it comes from a place of love for WWE. He gave so much of himself to that company, and he still watches the shows. He is still a fan. I took issue with him a few months ago, suggesting that WWE needs to start an all-women's brand, because if you watch these main roster shows, and I'm not counting NXT in this, if you watch those main roster shows, I don't know how the hell you could think having these people running an all-women's brand would be anything but a complete disaster. So I disagreed. But he is well within his rights to have that opinion. And frankly, I think he's too nice on WWE. But I don't think the man has a mean bone in his entire body. Which is kind of funny considering, you know, when you look back at his career, all the hardcore stuff that he did. But I don't think he's got a mean bone in his body. So for him to say, hey, WWE, we got a problem here, and point out that they may no longer be the place where young wrestlers aspire to be, and that it's a problem of their own making that they need to fix, for Mick Foley to call out WWE for that, I think really says a lot. And if you listen to this podcast every week, and I know you do, because you guys are really smart people, then there is nothing you heard there in what Mick Foley said that you have not already heard me say dozens of times. I'm not sure I would trust the powers that be with my career in their hands. That's Mick Foley saying that. About the company that turned him into a global star, he recognizes that the same people who helped make him a huge star are now more likely to have the opposite effect on people's careers. And he is hoping that all of this talk about AEW and all these people that are jumping and defecting over might light enough of a fire under them to wake them up. And then I hear from Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men Wrestling Podcast that people are very unhappy within WWE that Foley put that video out on his Facebook page. And that there is an unwritten rule within the company that legends should not disparage the company. This is a man who took years off of his life and put his body through ungodly amounts of abuse for this company. Mick Foley has earned the right to say whatever the fuck he wants to without having to worry about getting heat from people in WWE. It's a lot easier to be mad at the person telling the truth than it is to admit that there's a problem and actually do something to try to fix it. It's a lot easier just to be mad and pass the blame. They should be upset with what he said. They have every right to be upset with what he said because everything he said is true. So they should be upset with it. They shouldn't be upset with him for saying it. They should be upset because it's true. Now they're not going to listen to somebody like me, right? After all, I'm just a fan with an opinion. My opinion doesn't count. But maybe his will. Maybe more people like Mick Foley coming out and saying what needs to be said and not being afraid that WWE might yank their Legends deal. Maybe that'll get their attention if enough of them actually said something. Yeah, you know, we're still making truckloads of money for now. But what can we be doing to make these shows, especially those 3 hours on Mondays, what can we be doing to make them more fun to watch? You know, SmackDown at Madison Square Garden this week, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, was the best 2 hours of television that they have produced all year. I wish they could bottle that up and bottle that crowd up and take it with them on the road every week, wherever they go. But what can we be doing to put on shows like that more often? They can't all be home runs every week, but certainly we can have a show that does not offend, that does not bore, that does not make me angry, that does not make me go, what the hell are these people doing? What can we be doing to make this place more attractive to people who for years, years, would be jumping through hoops set on fire for a spot on our roster? What can we do to fix that? Instead, the first thing we hear is that Mick Foley has heat with certain people for the comments that he made. This is why nothing ever really changes. So good on Mick Foley for saying what needed to be said. I only wish more people in his position had the guts to do the same. This is episode 721 of the Solomonster Sounds of... Man, I'm already on one rant in. I haven't even done the intro yet. For Sunday, September 12th, 2021... Audible is back up. For those of you wondering, I did mention that they were moving servers, switching platforms. The link wasn't working. Well, guess what? It's up and running again. You want to take advantage. Now is the time. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Sign up for a 30-day trial. You get one free audiobook of your choice, courtesy of the podcast. And you get to keep that book no matter what, whether you stick with Audible beyond the trial or not. If you cancel, that book belongs to you. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out like these fine folks here. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you. That's amazing. Night Stalker, Naif Alsafar. John Loose Cannon Lopez. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Killshot, Keith Hart. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Ostentatious Alan Carter. John Raging Mad Riffle. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. The Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes. Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd. Caleb Showtime Lindley. Want to wish a happy birthday to Armando over in Bayamon, Puerto Rico. Monday is his birthday, and he and his brother are both big fans of the show, so happy birthday to Armando. And happy birthday to Suleiman, who is turning 20 years old this Tuesday. And I know he is a big fan of the show as well. So Suleiman, happy birthday. I hope you have a great day on Tuesday. And check out the Super Game and Chill Bros channel on YouTube. They are four guys who met in college. They decided to try their hand at YouTube. And they cover all sorts of topics. They hang around, they chill, they play games. Basically, they play the games when you can't. And if you ever want to get your game on, but you're too tired to actually play, come hang out with the boys and chill out. Just type in Super Game and Chill, that's apostrophe N, Super Game and Chill Bros, and give them a watch. the laziest gamers this side of Orange Cassidy. And thank you to all of our new channel members on YouTube. You guys have come out in full force over the past couple of weeks with all the streams and all the shows, all the content. And we have a bunch of new people on both the Superstar tier and the Legend tier, with more retro audio classic sound-offs that you can't find anywhere else going up in the next few weeks, so I thank you. By the way, we are a month away from the new Halloween Kills movie. It was delayed a year due to COVID. This week they announced that it'll be streaming on Peacock on the same day that it hits theaters, which I believe is October 15th, so I don't have to spend a small fortune to go see it at the theater. I can't wait. I might have to take the night off from the Rampage stream just to watch it. Maybe I'll do a review. So there's a lot of news to get into. I want to mention something up front that WWE announced. Then we're going to get into a whole bunch of AEW news and notes. We're going to talk Raw. We're going to talk SmackDown from Madison Square Garden, NXT, kind of the final lame duck show before this new 2.0 launch this week of the new NXT. We got mailbag questions, and later on at the end of the show, I am going to have some comments. Of course, this weekend is the 20-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. I did see the WWE documentary they put together called Never Forget. I'll have some thoughts on that. So that's all coming up on the show this week. But first, WWE being a publicly traded company, some things you just can't keep a secret. And this week they announced, even though I'm sure they would have preferred not to, that Triple H, Paul Levesque, underwent a successful procedure last week at Yale New Haven Hospital following what they described only as a cardiac event, which could be any number of things. It does not mean that he had a heart attack. They said that the episode was caused by a genetic heart issue, and he is expected to make a full recovery. That is great news. I hope he heals up quickly, because heart issues are nothing to joke about. Last Sunday, AEW presented its All Out pay-per-view from Chicago, the greatest pay-per-view, in my opinion, in company history. CM Punk looked like he didn't miss a beat after 7 years away with his win over Darby Allin. Minoru Suzuki made a surprise appearance that got a nice pop out of me, coming out to confront Jon Moxley after his win over Satoshi Kojima. The Young Bucks and the Lucha Bros tore the house down, put on one of the damnedest cage matches that you will ever see, crowning new tag team champions. Ruby Soho debuted as the Joker entrant in the Casino Battle Royal and won. And they closed out with the AEW debuts of Adam Cole joining the Elite, all of his Elite buddies, and Bryan Danielson fighting against the Elite. He did not come out to Final Countdown, which was a bummer. He came out to a remixed version of his Ride of the Valkyrie song that he used in WWE. Tony Khan did try to obtain the rights to Final Countdown for Danielson, but even for him, even for Tony, the cost was just too high. Now, how high, you might ask? Well, that's what Matt Riddle wants to know. Lenny Leonard chimed in on Twitter. He used to do the announcing for Ring of Honor many years ago. He's also announced for a whole bunch of promotions. Lenny Leonard has been around for years. He's announced for Evolve and Shimmer and Dragon Gate, among other places. But he claimed that when ROH went to pay-per-view in 2008 and they inquired about the rights to use the song for Danielson, the band Europe, whether, I don't know if it was Europe or the record company, whoever it was, on behalf of Europe, wanted something like $50,000 per play each time they used the song. I don't know if that means, like, if he made an entrance for a match and then won the match and then they played his music, if that would be $100,000 for one night, or if that was $50,000 per night. Either way, that's quite ridiculous. But do you know what that means? Do you know what that means? If they got rid of QT Marshall's contract, we could have gotten Final Countdown at All Out. But in comments that he made in the ring after the show went off the air, Danielson had praise for his former employer, which got boos from the crowd. But Danielson made it very clear he was happy in WWE. He did not bash them. He's not bitter. He has no reason, really, to be bitter about anything in WWE. He was happy there.
And he's, as he said, he still chose to leave and come to AEW because he wanted a new challenge. He wanted to work with a lot of the younger talents on the roster and work other places elsewhere in the world. Per The Observer, WWE did give him a major offer to stay and even promised him the ability to work matches for New Japan, including Vince McMahon supposedly giving him permission to work the G1 Climax. Now, I understand that Vince McMahon may not watch any wrestling outside of WWE, but Hogan and Andre, and probably others, and this is years ago, but even still, Hogan, Andre, they've worked the G1 before. I'm sure Vince McMahon has heard of the G1, but I doubt that he knows the kind of time commitment that would be required of somebody to actually be in the tournament. I doubt that he has any clue at all about that. But I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation, with Brian trying to explain to Vince McMahon how the G1 works. This year's tournament, I mean, especially the bracket, it looks pretty lame, to be honest with you. But next year, the idea of Brian and maybe even Punk being in the G1 is pretty fucking cool. Adam Cole. Praise the wrestling gods. Adam Cole made the right choice. He left WWE in the rearview mirror. In the media scrum after the show, he said his NXT contract coming due when it did in June was as much a surprise to him as it was to the folks in WWE, corroborating the reports at the time that came out. He was under the impression that he had another 6 months left on his deal. All of a sudden, he went from thinking he'd be talking about a new contract in December to talking about a new deal in the span of about 72 hours. He confirmed the reports. You know, those reports from the dirt sheets that some of you love to claim are always wrong. You'll shout from the highest rooftop when they are wrong, but when they're right, boy, you people are awfully quiet. You know who you are. But he confirmed that he signed a short-term extension of his WWE deal to allow him to finish up his angle with Kyle O'Reilly. He's a very good friend of his. And he also confirmed the report that he met with Vince McMahon backstage at SmackDown, and he said the meeting was very positive. They had a great talk. He didn't say what they spoke about. He said he can be a little intimidating, but he said it was a very positive conversation. He did, in the media scrum, address the importance of being able to maintain streaming on his Twitch account. And I want to read you just the full quote here because I think it's important to put context to this and really show you how important this is. Some people kind of dismiss it. Oh, it's video games. It's Twitch. What's the big deal? But this just goes to show you how important this is to him. He said, "It is incredibly important to me. Twitch was sort of something I started over the pandemic and wanted to do for a long time, but hadn't really taken the time to teach myself. Initially, I really did do it just because I really like video games. But then what started from the Twitch stream was this community of people that would all come together and share that passion over video games. I have gotten so many messages from people who are going through a really, really rough time, and the only thing they looked forward to at that time were those streams. I feel a connection with a lot of these people. I know a lot of them by name. Social media can be a really nasty place sometimes, and there is none of that in the Twitch streams. So I adore doing that. I am so happy that I'm still doing it. I don't plan on stopping anytime soon." And I can understand him feeling that way because I get messages and I read them on the podcast sometimes from you guys. I get messages a lot from people who say similar things. Going through a rough time, whether it's an illness or a death in the family or someone lost their job, or someone's just depressed or had a bad breakup, whatever it might be. Everybody has their own stories and tough times that they're going through, but they say, oh, listening to the podcast or watching the streams for 2-3 hours, even just for those few hours, helps take my mind off things. And I love getting messages like that because it just shows to me, even when you may not be thinking about it, the power that a simple podcast can have. And I'm sure a lot of other content creators get messages like that all the time too. And those are the messages that really resonate with me. So I can understand him feeling like, wait, you know, we have this community here. I get these really cool messages from people. This is not the sort of thing that I ever want to stop doing. So it goes beyond just video games. I understand the importance of building a community and what that means to a lot of people. I can relate to that. I can understand where he's coming from when he says that. And Adam Cole is a total class act. He did business the right way on his way out. He stayed when he didn't have to finish up and put over his buddy. He could have really put the company in a bind. But he didn't want to do that to Kyle O'Reilly. He didn't want to do that to Triple H. Triple H was good to him. It's all the uncertainty that I had about him on the main roster when he was out of the, you know, out of the nest, so to speak, that concerned me. But Triple H positioned him as a top guy on that brand for the 4 years that he was there. He did things the right way on the way out. And in making the move from WWE to AEW, in his own words, he called it a fairly easy decision. Danielson has talked about how difficult of a decision it was. He could have gone either way. And it really was only in the final few weeks before he debuted that he made the final decision that he was going to make the jump. But that was a very telling quote, I think, from Adam Cole, who said, no, making the jump here was a fairly easy decision for me to make. Of course it was. Of course it was. Adam Cole, I said this on Twitter, Adam Cole has made tougher decisions about what to eat for fucking dinner than he did deciding to make the jump from WWE to AEW. Do I go with the steak tartare or do I go with the pasta primavera? That was a lot harder to decide than this was. Especially when we read about what WWE's plan was for him had he decided to stay with the company and make that move to the main roster. We learned this week, as first reported by Ringside News, and I wanted to wait to see if anybody else reported it before I even commented on it, because that you never hear me mention that name on this podcast typically, but it was a few days later that Meltzer backed up the report. He said that one of the ideas for Adam Cole to move up to the main roster was to become a manager for a heel Keith Lee. This was either Vince McMahon or Bruce Pritchard's idea. They basically share the same brain, so you may as well just say it's Vince McMahon's idea. Because I'm sure Bruce Pritchard, when he comes up with ideas, he's coming up with ideas because he's worked for this guy for so long that in his mind, oh, Vince is going to like this. So it's Vince McMahon's idea. Let's just call it what it is. The belief is that the idea was presented to Adam Cole during that meeting that he had with Vince McMahon, which he now confirms he did have. They were said to be looking for a dynamic similar to what Leo Rush had with Bobby Lashley, where Rush, who was the small man in that duo, would talk a big talk and then he would hide behind the bigger man. And Meltzer says he also thought that they might change Cole's name because they already have Michael Cole on TV. Because wrestling fans are fucking stupid, you see, and apparently they can't handle two people having the same name. That's like changing Steven Regal to William Regal, because they already had too many Steves. They had Steve Austin and they had Steve Blackman. There's another Steve whose name escapes me. We can't have that. We got to change this guy's name. They wanted to bring up Adam Cole, who spent 4 years in NXT having some of the best matches in the entire company, main event level talent, who was in high profile programs and feuds. The longest reigning NXT champion of all time. He had an established identity. It's not like NXT is being hidden away at Full Sail like it was for years. The show has been on USA Network now for a couple of years, and Adam Cole has been at the forefront on this brand, like I said before, for the entire time that he's there. People know who he is. His name has been established on television. The man headlined a sold-out takeover show at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn against Johnny Gargano for the NXT Championship, the greatest match in NXT history. Served as the leader of a dominant faction for the majority of those 4 years, Let's call him up and make him a manager. And maybe change his name while we're at it. This is the same company that, and I will never, I still get questions from people about this. And is this true? Yes, it is true. It's from her own lips. This is the same company that wanted Thunder Rosa to try out for them, not as a wrestler, but as a referee. But even more than that, it would have been, and this is the thing that bothers me the most when I hear stuff like this, it would have been yet another slap in the face of NXT. And the fans who followed his career all throughout his run on NXT. If that's how they viewed him. And I told you, how many times did I say it on this show? Vince McMahon is going to take one look at Adam Cole and think, my God, this guy is small. Look at how short he is. Look at how skinny his arms are. And he would have very little chance of breaking out at a high level. Is there a chance? Of course, there's always a chance. There's always a chance. And Cole is a very talented guy. Maybe he would have shocked me and maybe he would have found a way to make it work. But why does he have to face these obstacles and these roadblocks in the first place? That's what gets me. Very little chance. Remember Road Dogg? If only he had the size of a Karrion Kross, he would be Universal Champion. Well, guess what? He's not the size of a Karrion Kross. So it was best for him to walk away when he did. Now he's in AEW. And he'll be making his in-ring debut this Wednesday on Dynamite in Newark against Frankie Kazarian. I like how on Wednesday he also got up in Tony Schiavone's face for getting a little too chummy with Britt Baker. Everyone is protective of Britt Baker. Tony Schiavone on his podcast with Conrad talked about hearing that Terry Taylor was asking about her. I don't know how long ago this was, but you know, Terry Taylor works at the PC for WWE. He's been back with the company for a number of years now. And I guess Tony must have thought that maybe he was trying to do a little potential recruiting for WWE, asking about Britt Baker. So Schiavone sent Taylor a text message simply saying, "Don't you ever ask about her again. Go fuck yourself." He's like an overprotective father. But it's Terry Taylor. So the only acceptable thing to say is to tell him to go fuck himself. Especially after I was reminded all over again last week of the Daphne stuff from TNA. Terry Taylor can indeed go fuck himself. But all the momentum from the pay-per-view led to Dynamite on Wednesday doing its second biggest overall audience in the history of the show, second only to the premiere episode 2 years ago, doing over 1.3 million viewers on TNT. The high point was 1.5 million for the segment with the Elite, Adam Cole and Bryan Danielson, in the 18 to 49 demo that everybody talks about. And when you see those charts each week from Showbuzz Daily, and it's very cool, I'm glad that site is back up and running, that chart that you see, that color chart with the rankings of the top 50 or top 100, whatever it is, that's not the overall chart. If you look, that's the 18 to 49 chart. That's what they issue. That's what they put out each week. The show is up 40% from the week before. And for the very first time, it topped what Monday Night Raw did this week in the same demo. Now, it was only 3,000 viewers more. I think it was the difference between 681,000 and 678,000. But still, happened a lot faster than I thought it would. I said this on Twitter, and then I muted all my responses because there's just too many brain-dead WWE apologists cluttering my timeline, so I just let them argue amongst themselves. But I made a very non-controversial statement, I thought. But that didn't stop the WWE stans from losing their minds. But it is true. I said Dynamite pulling 1.3 million viewers and topping what Raw did in the key demo is impressive, but this week, they probably won't top what Raw does in the demo. And they probably won't do 1.3 million viewers again. Ratings go up, ratings go down. There's peaks and valleys. That goes for both companies. The key takeaway from all of this is less so the actual number this week The key takeaway is that 3 years ago, this company didn't even exist. It was a thought. It was an idea. It did not exist. AEW was only 2 years old. And here they are putting up numbers like that. That is the real story here. That is what I find more impressive than any single number up to this point that they have done. When Impact did 2 million viewers for that one episode in 2010 when they debuted Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair and Eric Bischoff all on the same night, that was the January 4th show. I remember it because it went head-to-head with Bret Hart's return on Raw. But that night, you know, TNA, on that show, they pulled in just shy of 3 million viewers for that one 15-minute segment where Hogan walked out. That was the peak. But they had already been around for about 8 years by that point. And after that, they plummeted. I mean, they never saw numbers like that ever again. They never even came close to seeing numbers like that ever again. Now, of course, TNA never did the kind of pay-per-view numbers that AEW has been doing. Tony Khan said on Busted Open on Friday morning that All Out was their biggest pay-per-view ever, which I think going in, a lot of us suspected it would be. I said it would be disappointing if it wasn't, given what was being promoted and Punk's first match in 7 years. It would have been disappointing to find out that this wasn't the most purchased pay-per-view in the history of the company. But he confirmed that it was, and that it did somewhere well over 200,000 buys. We don't have the exact number yet, but it is somewhere in that 200,000, probably to 220 range. TNA never had a pay-per-view that did more than 55,000. That was for the Kurt Angle Samoa Joe cage match. So that's a big deal for AEW. That is the biggest buy rate for a non-WWE wrestling pay-per-view in more than 20 years. You'd have to go all the way back to WCW Mayhem in 1999. So if bringing in established names like CM Punk and Bryan Danielson helps draw attention to their less established names like MJF, like Darby Allin and Powerhouse Hobbs, and people like that, and people who are watching the show like what they see and they stick around, then they've hit upon a winning formula. It remains to be seen if they can maintain these numbers in the long haul. TNA didn't do it. Can AEW do it? I think they have a better shot at it than Impact did. But are there enough wrestling fans left to sustain that? Can AEW give them enough of what they want to see to sustain and build upon those numbers? Because right now, they have all the momentum on their side. Give people what they want to see, I believe, and they will reward you for it. They gave me Minoru Suzuki in the main event on TNT, Wednesday night against Jon Moxley, and they cut off his entrance because they were running long. We got some bad time management by AEW and WWE on Wednesday and then on Friday. Moxley picked up the win. They only went 8 minutes. Suzuki, he suffered a nasty gash above his eye. He needed 7 stitches when the show is over. But it looks like Suzuki is not done yet with AEW. AEW announced that Suzuki will appear on Dynamite in Newark this week alongside his former Suzuki goon stablemate, Lance Archer, to issue a new challenge to Jon Moxley. They said Suzuki and Archer were both furious about the preferential hometown treatment that Moxley received in Cincinnati. I don't know if all of this, if this was part of the plan all along or not, to bring him back. But I love that Tony Khan recognized how upset a certain segment of his audience was that Suzuki's entrance was cut short when, I mean, honestly, half the fun is singing along to his song. And now they're bringing him back. Better give us the full entrance this time. But Suzuki is a freelancer. I think he has been for years, like Liger was. I don't think he's actually under a New Japan deal, so he can probably book his own dates. He is booked for the GCW show on the 24th against Homicide. He's wrestling Jonathan Gresham on the GCW show actually this Friday in LA. But the week after that, he wrestles Homicide in Queens. And that is only 2 days after the Arthur Ashe show. Also, in Queens, which just passed 18,000 tickets sold, by the way. I was thinking, before yesterday, I was thinking that it could be Moxley and Homicide against Archer and Suzuki on the 22nd, but that's only because I figured that night they were going to have Eddie Kingston challenge Miro again for the TNT title. But at the AEW Dark tapings at Universal Studios yesterday, they did their first tapings at Universal this weekend. Kingston threw out the challenge himself. It's going to be Eddie Kingston and Jon Moxley against Lance Archer and Minoru Suzuki in New York. That looks to be the match. Yeah, they also could have done Archer and Suzuki as babyfaces against Dan Lambert's men, Ethan Page and Scorpio Sky. Given Archer's issues with them in the past, they could have gone down that road, but it looks like it's going to be Kingston and Mox against Suzuki and Archer. On Friday night on Rampage, we got the Pac-Andrade match that was bumped from the All Out pay-per-view. I thought they had a very good match. It was missing something. I think that they could go out and have an even better match than the one they had on Friday. I don't know if it's part of it was just the crowd was tired because they had seen so much. You know, this was a taped show. They taped this after Dynamite this week in Cincinnati. So it was very good, but not at the level of what I thought they could go out there and do. When the match was over, Andrade punched Chavo Guerrero in the face and left him to the wolves to be abused by the Lucha Bros and by Pac because Chavo had interfered. It was a very lame finish to the match, but I guess it was a means to an end if they are breaking Chavo away from Andrade. Chavo interfered. He hit Pac with an iPad and Andrade got the pin. I guess Andrade didn't like that. So it appears as if the partnership between Chavo and Andrade is already done. The second manager now that Andrade has gone through in 3 months in the company. And I said on the stream Friday night, all signs seem to point that Ric Flair is probably coming into AEW. I wonder if they would save him for the Arthur Ashe show, right? 18,000 people. Here comes Ric Flair. That's what I'm expecting. Now, one of the things I talked about the other night during my Dynamite post show was the challenge that Tony Khan now has in front of him. The honeymoon period will soon end for AEW. And with the roster they have, he's going to have to fit all of the pieces where they belong. You ever see one of these 2,000-piece jigsaw puzzles? My uncle, he loves doing them. I buy one for his birthday every year. It keeps him busy, sitting there trying to figure out where all the pieces go. If there's even one little piece missing, he just loses his mind. But that's what Tony Khan has to do with this roster. Or he's liable to end up with some disgruntled wrestlers. I said that on Wednesday night. Not even 24 hours later, we had our very first example of what I was talking about. When former Lucha Underground ring announcer Melissa Santos, who is married to Brian Cage, went public with her frustrations about the way that her husband is being used in AEW. She was being interviewed, I don't know by who. She only clipped this one question and posted it as a screenshot on her Twitter. But the interviewer asked if she felt that Cage was being misused by AEW. And this is what she had to say. Cage, to me, is lost in the shuffle right now in AEW. He and Powerhouse Hobbs could be an excellent tag team. And Cage, in his own right, is a top guy in every sense of the word. AEW just hasn't seemed to realize that yet. Hopefully, once the dust settles from all of the new arrivals, Cage will get his opportunity and have a chance to shine. And since then, she has been taking up for him on Twitter from angry AEW fans tweeting back at her. I understand a wife wanting to support her husband. I'm wondering if her husband has gone to Tony Khan to voice these frustrations. She's not voicing these frustrations unless he is frustrated. Okay, it's not a situation where Brian Cage is just happy to be there, and his wife is going out on her own and saying that, no, you know, they're misusing him. Obviously, he must feel the same way. So, I am wondering, has he gone to Tony Khan to express this directly to the boss? Or is their strategy to just go on Twitter and complain about it? Because I don't think that's a very effective strategy. But let's look at this. I wanted to take a look really, really quickly here at Brian Cage's run so far in AEW. Now, he was hurt. When they signed him, remember, I think it was an arm injury. He had an injury. They signed him. They allowed him to recover and heal up from the injury. And then he debuted last year in the casino ladder match, a double or nothing, and he won, which earned him the right to challenge for the AEW championship. His very first match, his very first night in, he got the win. Then he challenged Jon Moxley for the AEW title on Dynamite, and they protected him in defeat by having Taz throw in the towel, knowing that Cage would never submit. He was locked in the armbar that Moxley put on, and Taz threw the towel in. Right? He never gave up, he never got pinned or anything like that, so they protected him. He got a big surprise win on Dynamite a few months ago over Hangman Page, and then opened the show at Double or Nothing this year with a hot match against Page. That was a great match that those two had. Sting, right? He was part of Sting's first match in AEW, the cinematic match with Team Taz against Sting and Darby. So Cage has been featured in some big spots in the time that he has now been with AEW, which isn't even a full... I mean, he's been under contract for over a year and a half, but since he debuted on television, hasn't quite yet been a year and a half. Now, right now, the feud with Team Taz, it is very cold. It is a very cold feud. They're getting ready to blow it off soon. They're going to have him one-on-one against Ricky Starks. Win or lose, that should be the end of that. And then we'll see where Tony Khan fits him in after that. But the fact is this, Brian Cage is not over at the level of their top guys right now, which doesn't mean that he can't be. But they just brought in a lot of those names. They still have that, you know, that new car smell. And I'm not sure the acquisitions are done yet. I mean, if you listen to what Tony Khan has said, the acquisitions are not done. There's still more yet to come in the months ahead. So I can understand him and his wife being frustrated. Honestly, I think Lance Archer has been more misused than Brian Cage has. Cage, at least, has been largely protected in the matches that he's lost. I can't say the same for Lance Archer. But the one big knock on Brian Cage, and it's the one big knock on him that I have, is his promo work. He's just not very good on the microphone. When it comes to cutting promos and doing the talking for himself, he is not very good. In the ring, he's impressive. The things he does for a man his size, the way that he kind of invents certain moves that I've never seen before. I mean, his work is good, but splitting him away from Taz was not the best idea because he really does need somebody doing the talking for him, which got me thinking. On that note, why not his wife? I mean, she's already doing the talking for him anyway, it seems. She's already doing the job. I'm serious. I'm not even trying to be funny. Why not sign Melissa Santos? Then maybe she's not interested. Maybe she's doing something else. Why not sign Melissa Santos and use her as a manager for Brian Cage? You know, Cage won't be the only one that we hear about being frustrated with their spot. We're gonna hear more of this. There is going to be more of this in the months to come. This was to be expected. With all of the new names coming in, how Tony Khan navigates this and responds to this is going to be very interesting to see because you cannot please everybody. And there will be a time where we stop hearing about AEW signing ex-WWE people and we see some AEW names jumping over to WWE. It's inevitable. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I guarantee you it will happen. Just a matter of when. The big question is, who's going to be the first name to jump? Kenny Omega was ranked number one in this year's PWI Top 500, beating out Roman Reigns, who came in at number two. And, oh boy, WWE fans had a complete meltdown when they saw that. I mean, I get that it's cool for the wrestlers if they make the list. A lot of them probably grew up reading the PWI Top 500, so if you see your name on that list, I can understand that being special and feeling like a big deal, but for everybody else, come on. This is not 25 years ago, okay? This is not 30 years ago. This is not a big deal. I saw people going to war over it on social media. But for those interested, The evaluation period was July 1st of 2020 through June 30th of this year, which would include Kenny Omega's title defense on Dynamite against Jungle Boy. This was the top 10 of the PWI 500 this year. Kenny Omega, number 1. Roman Reigns, number 2. Bobby Lashley, number 3. Drew McIntyre, number 4. Kota Ibushi, number 5. Jon Moxley, number 6. Will Ospreay, number 7. Finn Balor, number 8. Shingo Takagi, number 9. And Rich Swann at number 10. So there is some Impact representation on this list. He was, of course, the Impact Wrestling World Champion for a number of months. Had a nice run. Did Rich Swann. So that was nice, I guess, to see him recognized so high up on the list. But looking beyond that, let's expand this out to the top 25. Number 11 was Cody Rhodes. 12 was Randy Orton. 13 was Big E. 14, Darby Allin. 15, Tetsuya Naito from New Japan. 16, Karrion Kross. Well, he had a dominant run in NXT. I'll give him that. Number 17, Ultimo Guerrero. Getting my Ultimos mixed up. It used to be Ultimo Dragon. Here, I guess it's Ultimo Guerrero. Number 18 is Suwama from All Japan. Number 19, Chris Jericho. Number 20 is Jonathan Gresham. 21 is Orange Cassidy. 22, Laredo Kid. 23, Keiji Muto. 24, Keith Lee. And 25, Kazuchika Okada. I love how Okada did next to nothing this year. And he still made the top 25. What a legend. One man who did not make the top 25 in the PWI 500... he came in at number 63, is Kevin Owens. Fightful.com broke the news that his WWE contract is coming due a lot sooner than was previously reported. Now, 3 years ago, Owens did an interview, and he mentioned that he had just signed a 5-year deal to stay with WWE through the year 2023. But it turns out, after WWE signed their new TV contracts with Fox and NBC Universal, at a time where they were making record profits, the company restructured a lot of talent contracts. So Owens is not the only one. He's only the one that we know about so far. We'll get more names, I think, in the weeks ahead. Kevin Owens is the one that we know about. And his was one of those deals that was restructured. And this had nothing to do with the pandemic, because all of this happened before COVID even was a thing. But as part of that restructuring, Meltzer says his contract now expires on January 31st of 2022. There are conflicting reports about Sami Zayn's contract. I'm less sure about when his deal is up, so I don't really want to talk about him just yet. Owens decided to do a little bit of trolling and have some fun on Tuesday, and he tweeted, and then later deleted, a series of numbers that turned out to be the coordinates for Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore was also the name of a faction.
Okay. I found this on the web for as a number that turned out to be the coordinates for Mount Rushmore. Check it out.
Ah, you bitch. Interrupting me. It wouldn't be a podcast without Alexa interrupting me. Or Siri, or is it Alexa or Siri? I don't know. Anyway, turned out to be the coordinates for Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore was the name of a faction many years ago in PWG with Kevin Owens and the Young Bucks and Adam Cole. And he also changed the location on his Twitter profile to Almost There. Not long after that, the Bucks changed the location on their profile to the word There. And that's all they do. All they do on social media is troll all the time anyway. But they were also doing that before Adam Cole signed. And he ended up actually coming over to AEW. So you never really know how much of it is trolling and how much of it is a little more than just trolling. But they're having some fun with it. If you were to ask me, and I don't know Kevin Owens, I don't know where his head is at, you're asking me as a fan, you're asking me just my opinion, does Kevin Owens stay in WWE or does he leave? I think he's gone. I think Kevin Owens is gone when his contract is up. Unless some amazing promises are made to him by WWE, I think he's gone. And I just think back to the interview, and this is part of where my opinion is coming from on this. I think back to the interview that he did with Bleacher Report last fall. Shout out to Graham. Where he talked about how every time WWE does a draft, he always flip-flops from one brand to the other. And how he just assumed the same would happen to him again, which it did. And he was hopeful that it would give him a fresh start. He said, I went to go find the quote. He said, I don't know what it is about me. I feel like I give it my all. I deliver every time I'm on the air. But for some reason, I feel like I always end up in a situation where I could always use a fresh start after a little while. I always try my best to do that, so it always helps to get a new platform. Here I am again, 1 year later, and last year I was so desperate to move from Raw, or rather, I was so desperate to move to Raw. I'm thinking most people are desperate to move away from Raw, but in this case he was desperate to move to Raw, and he said, I got moved to Raw, and now I'm pretty desperate to move to SmackDown, because for some reason I don't feel like things are working out for me on Raw. Maybe it'll be better on SmackDown. But at this time last year, I didn't think things were working out for me on SmackDown, and I thought Raw maybe would be the place. And, you know, he also talked about being upset how late into a lot of these drafts that he usually gets picked. I think even 1 year, wasn't he picked last? I think he was picked last. And you would think, oh, it's just a draft. It's all, you know, kayfabe. It's not a big deal. But, yeah, no, you know what? You can understand. Here's a guy who has been Universal Champion before. And probably has a chip on his shoulder, and I'm sure thinks a lot of his work, rightfully. And when you're picked, it's like being picked last in dodgeball. Not that I can relate to that. I was second to last. But imagine you're the kid on the team who nobody wants to pick, and everybody else is going, and then it's like, well, you're the only one left, so come on. You know, come join our team. And that's how he felt. And he also talked about how it was always very stressful because you form travel partners on the road, and a lot of these decisions, you're not given a heads up about where you're going to go. A lot of these decisions are probably not even made until the day of. And that affects your life. It affects your job. Because you're so used to traveling with this person and carpooling and sharing expenses, and all of a sudden they surprise you on the air. Surprise! You know, you're changing shows. And, you know, you can understand how something like that would be very stressful. But I remember reading that interview. It stood out to me. This was only a few years ago. And it really stood out to me in my mind how almost deflated. Like it was written text. But it's almost as if I could hear his voice and how deflated he sounded in the words that he was saying. And since his main roster call-up, Kevin Owens, as I said, he's been Universal Champion. And frankly, I don't think he's really been the same since that loss to Goldberg, but Universal Champion, he's been Intercontinental Champion, United States Champion. He once powerbombed Machine Gun Kelly off the Raw stage, which is personally one of my favorite moments of his. And now he's messing around on TV with Logan Paul. He's doing talk show segments with a necktie around his neck in a t-shirt. I don't get the sense that Kevin Owens is completely satisfied in his role right now with WWE. He had the program with Roman Reigns for the Universal title. They had some really good matches together. He did not win the championship because it just wasn't the right time for him to win the title. It would have been crazy to take the title off Roman Reigns then, just as it is right now. But it feels like they just don't really know what to do with him. I think they take him for granted. I think they enjoy having him around because he could be a babyface. He could be a heel. You need him to do a talk show segment and be funny? He can do that. You need to plug him into a big match and he can go out there and deliver in the ring? He could do that too. We've had him on commentary, do guest commentary. And he's very good at that as well. So he's a great player. I'm not trying to diminish him by calling him a utility guy, but I think that's kind of how they look at him. He's not one of their, you know, main event attractions to be protected at all costs, but boy, we're really glad that we have a guy like this off the bench because we could just plug him in. He's like Kane. right? I mean, not physically, but he's like Kane, where Kane was another one who was very versatile as a performer. And I think at times during his run, they took him for granted. But you can plug him in wherever you need him. You want him to be a heel monster? Great, he could do that. You want him to be, you know, the baby face doing the odd couple thing with Daniel Bryan or a tag team with Hurricane or whatever? Great. Plug him in there. Kane can do it. And I think that's kind of how they look at Kevin Owens, but I don't know that they really have a full appreciation for what they have in him. So here comes another draft in a few weeks. And yet again, Kevin Owens feels like he could probably use another fresh start on another brand. How many fresh starts is he supposed to get? The biggest fresh start that he could possibly get would be to leave and go somewhere else. Now, I'm not judging one way or the other. I'm not sitting here like I was for Adam Cole saying he's got to leave. I absolutely want to see him leave WWE. I said that about Adam Cole because I didn't see a future for Adam Cole on the main roster. It's not because I'm picking sides here. I'm working for this team or that team. Okay, don't be a dum-dum. I made it very clear why I wanted to see Adam Cole leave the company. That's not the same way I feel about Kevin Owens. I think that they could work something out with him. I think that there is a role for him, a more consistent role. Frankly, I think it's long overdue, probably for him to have a really solid heel run, like a vicious heel run, you know, at or near the top of one of the two brands. But if Kevin Owens is not satisfied with his current role and he thinks that he would be better off getting a fresh start somewhere else, Tony Khan would be crazy not to at least have a conversation with someone like him. You know, with all the names that they have right now, I think AEW needs to consider a G1 climax of their own next year under whatever name they want to give it. I think they could put together a hell of a tournament just with their own guys. Question is, do they need to start running live events next year? I think they do. I think the answer is yes, even if just on a limited basis. I mean, I don't ever see them doing a full-time house show schedule like WWE. I don't think that would be a great idea. But they have so many people, so many young guys. You see them on Dark and Dark Elevation, and you see them on Rampage and Dynamite too. You know, whether it's a Daniel Garcia or any of these other, you know, Fuego del Sol or any of these people that we've been seeing on television, they have so many people, so many young guys now under contract, and not all of them are necessarily working their own indie dates. I think a limited house show schedule would make sense for AEW. They've got to get some of that undercard talent working in the ring more. You know, before COVID hit, AEW already had some dates penciled in. Jim Ross confirmed it. They were going to begin doing some limited house show dates. And then COVID just completely wiped all those plans off the table. Well, as we climb out of it enough, where they're back in buildings in front of people, they're back on the road, they're out of Daly's place. I mean, we're not out of the pandemic yet, but AEW is back out there. I think it's the right time. As people are now coming back into the arenas, it makes sense to start planning some shows like that. Some other news and notes. WWE signed 21-year-old Olympic gold medal wrestler Gable Steveson this week to a long-term deal, giving the company only their second Olympic gold medalist, their first since Kurt Angle. His brother was already training at the Performance Center. He's already signed with WWE. Steveson will return for his senior year at the University of Minnesota, and he will try for a second NCAA title before he officially starts with WWE. WWE will be paying to set up a training facility for him in Minneapolis while he continues to go to college before starting full-time next May on television. That doesn't mean main roster, but that'll be his official WWE start. Brock Lesnar has been a mentor of his for a number of years. And I think just think, your WrestleMania 40 main event could very well be Brock Lesnar doing the honors and passing the torch for Gable Steveson. If he is even half as good at this as Angle or Lesnar turned out to be, they'll have a future main eventer on their hands in no time. Al Snow, who currently runs things for Ohio Valley Wrestling, he made headlines this week for saving a child's life who is almost pulled out to sea by a riptide at the beach. He was at the beach in Florida when he all of a sudden heard people yelling and screaming, and he turned and he saw a young boy was out in rough water. He was clearly in distress, and he could tell that the lifeguard was not going to make it to him in time. So he jumped into action. He dove into the water. He swam over. He pulled the kid to safety just as a wave started to pull him further out. And they both got taken under by the wave, and it made him think in that moment. He was thinking about what happened to Shad Gaspard last year, who drowned doing the exact same thing, trying to save his son. But thankfully, in this case, they were able to make it safely back to shore. So happy ending there to that story. This was the weirdest thing I saw all week. The New Day and The Undertaker will be starring in an interactive horror movie coming to Netflix on October 5th, the day before my birthday, and what a gift. It's called Escape the Undertaker. Here's the description. In this interactive film featuring WWE superstars, The Undertaker has set a trap for the decorated tag team The New Day at his mansion. What they don't know, the Undertaker's mansion is an extreme haunted house, packed to the brim with supernatural challenges. It's up to viewers to decide the fate of these three poor souls trying to survive the wrath of the Undertaker. It's too bad Bray Wyatt doesn't work for WWE anymore. I always thought that his character, honestly, would make for a better horror movie villain than a pro wrestler. So maybe they could have put him in some kind of horror movie that went straight to Netflix. I think he actually would have excelled, frankly. If he wanted to just give the wrestling thing up, I think if he wanted to try his hand at acting and being in, you know, horror films and stuff, I actually think he would do quite well. But look, I am all about horror movies and Halloween season, so I'll be watching this. I don't know if it'll be any good, but even if it isn't, I think it'll be worth it just for the review on the podcast. And I want to send congrats to Booker T and the team at Reality of Wrestling, which is his promotion based out of Texas. They signed a deal to bring ROW to television in 50 markets nationwide. If you are in Texas, starting on September 18th, the show will air on CW 33 in Dallas, ABC 7 in Tyler, Texas, and ABC 9 in Lufkin, Texas. And then starting October 1st, ROW will air on Right Now TV, which is available in 20 markets, including Atlanta, Las Vegas, Nashville, Albany, and Los Angeles. And then in mid-October, they join the Action Channel in 26 additional markets. I don't see New York City on that list, but they do post full episodes on their YouTube channel. And they have a good product. So if you've never checked them out before, if you've never seen a Reality of Wrestling show before, again, you can head over to their YouTube channel and you can find a lot of content over there. But congrats to Booker and Brad and all the members of the ROW team. That is very cool. Raw from Monday. We're going to get through this quickly because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this show. They found a way to kill a lot of time with that tag team turmoil match that they had, this long gauntlet throughout the entire show, to determine who would challenge Randy Orton and Matt Riddle for the tag team championships tomorrow night. A match that is no longer happening, by the way. More on that in a second. Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods took a little break from Undertaker's haunted mansion to dress up like the Outsiders in their Wolfpack gear. I guess Halloween has come early. They beat the Viking Raiders, they beat Jinder Mahal and Veer, they beat the Lucha House Party, they beat Mason T-Bar. Look at all these quality teams here in this division. Well, the Viking Raiders are a quality team. The rest I can't necessarily say the same for. But Mason T-Bar did not take their loss very well. And they destroyed the New Day afterwards. So the gauntlet was temporarily halted until later in the show, because the New Day were unable to continue, even though I think that should have been a forfeit. But they decided to delay things until later on in the show. Sheamus pinned Drew McIntyre with a fistful of trunks to earn the right to challenge Damian Priest for the United States Championship at Extreme Rules. After the match, McIntyre whacked Sheamus in the head with the face mask that he had yanked off Sheamus' face during the match. And then he dropped him with a Claymore kick. This was McIntyre's second straight pinfall loss on TV. I don't see this as a slow build to a heel turn as much as I do. Hey, we have a draft coming in a few weeks, and I think Drew McIntyre is going to move to SmackDown. That's what it looks like to me. You know, Roman Reigns is going to need a new opponent once he finishes up with Finn Balor, and they do the match with Brock Lesnar. And it's a match that I would love to see after that great match they had at Survivor Series last year. I think we only had a taste of what those two guys can do in the ring together. So if he's changing brands, then it doesn't matter if he loses. Rhea Ripley and Nikki A.S.H. are officially doing the odd couple tag team thing, which is completely lazy, given that we already have an oddball pairing on this show. On the same show. We have Randy Orton and Matt Riddle. And we have it on NXT to a lesser degree with Io Shirai and Zoe Stark. So we have to do it again here. We don't have anything better for these two women. Let's just slap them together. Hilarity will ensue. I also just hate seeing Rhea Ripley dragged down with this shit. You cannot argue that she is in a better position now than she was a year ago. All this is doing is dragging her down. I am pulling for Rhea Ripley to move to SmackDown. She can hop on Drew Mac. Actually, Drew can probably hop on her back. She could probably carry him around. And they can both walk off to SmackDown together. But her and Nikki got a win over Natty and Tamina in a non-title match. So it might just be wishful thinking on my part, because it looks like they're going to be a team going forward. And they might even win the belts. And that still would not be a great position, in my opinion, for someone like Rhea Ripley to be in. We had Moist TV with Karrion Kross. The less said about this dripstick nonsense, the better. The most important thing is that they seem to have pulled their heads out of their asses and have been giving Kross some dominant wins on TV. I still think his gear is most unfortunate, but at least he's winning matches. Charlotte Flair retained the Raw Women's title against Nia Jax with a distraction assist from Shayna Baszler, who was ringside for the match. She was in Nia's corner. Those two are headed for Splitsville, which is long overdue. The best thing I can say about it is that there were no spots where it looked like someone was nearly killed. Otherwise, I'm glad this is over. After the match, Alexa Bliss appeared with her doll to challenge Charlotte to a championship match. Charlotte accepted, and the crowd was into Alexa. Alexa has a lot of fans. Call them fans, call them stans, whatever you want to call them. If you hang around on social media, you will find out very quickly that Alexa Bliss has a lot of fans. A very loyal following. They sell cameos with her from time to time. WWE does. For $600 a pop, you get like 15 seconds of her on a swing set, smiling at you, and they always sell out. Very loyal, dedicated fan base. There was a 24/7 title defense with Reginald against Tozawa. Jeff Hardy was part of the jobber parade that ran out after the match to chase after the title, and people were very upset about this. I was also very surprised to see him out there. Not that they've been doing a whole lot with him on TV, but still, you know, when you get to a certain level, and then you see someone doing stuff like this, it's jarring. And Jeff was very diplomatic when he did a radio interview this week, and they asked him about it. They asked him about being part of that. He said, yeah, it's one of those things. I do what they need me to do, and then I move on. That's in the past, and this Monday is the future, so I'm super excited. I'm just so grateful to have this opportunity to still be a WWE superstar, so I'm very thankful and grateful for every show that I'm on. It don't matter what I'm doing. I'm just so blessed to be part of WWE still. And given his history and given his past, I can understand why he would be grateful to still be employed by WWE. They've been very forgiving of him in the past. But you see, Jeff Hardy is, he's just happy to be there. His body is also beaten to shit, I'm sure. I don't know that he has one last big run, big singles run left in him. But to see him out there chasing after the joke belt is sad. Very sad. So then tag team turmoil resumed, with New Day beating Ali and Mansoor before falling to AJ Styles and Omos. Bobby Lashley and MVP were the final team to enter, and when Omos tagged into the ring against Lashley, people were into it, because it was two big dudes going at it for the first time. And Omos just, I mean, he dwarfed Bobby Lashley, just towered over him. Crowd was chanting for Lashley, interestingly. For the finish, Styles went for the forearm, Lashley speared him and got the win. To earn he and MVP a tag team championship match against RK-Bro. But wait, plans change. And even though earlier in the night, Lashley and MVP accepted Randy Orton's challenge to a match at Extreme Rules for the WWE title, now that match is suddenly being advertised for Raw tomorrow night. It'll probably still happen at Extreme Rules because we'll get a fuck finish of some kind tomorrow, but it's almost as if somebody realized late in the week, oh shit, Monday Night Football is back tomorrow night. We better throw something big out there so we don't lose 30% of our audience. 'Tis that time of year. Oh, it's pigskin time. If you thought the Raw numbers were bad now, just wait for what's coming. Every year they get lower and lower and lower. But apparently we're getting a WWE title match on TV tomorrow night. But enough about Raw. Let's talk about something important here for a minute. Do you know that using the internet without ExpressVPN is like checking in your baggage at the airport without a lock? Why would you do that? You only think that your stuff is being kept private, but you never know who might be rummaging through your belongings. You got that cream your doctor prescribed for you, that really embarrassing rash on your, I don't have to spell it out for the world. Or that toy your girlfriend made you buy from that shop in Amsterdam. You really don't want anyone to find that. When you go online without a VPN, your service provider can see every single website that you visit. Even worse, they can then legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and tech giants who then use your data to target you. So when you start getting ads for the Golden Girls box set on DVD or Poly Grip for your dentures, all because you were searching for gifts for grandma's birthday, you'll know why. It's pretty creepy, isn't it? How it seems like they know so much about you. With ExpressVPN, I can browse more anonymously. Nobody can see my online activity, and my data is encrypted for maximum protection. It's easy to use, too. I just fire up the app, click one button, and boom, I'm protected. You don't have to jump through hoops to use it, and it works on all devices, phones, laptops, even routers, so everyone who shares your Wi-Fi can be protected. Now, I can only tell you the experience that I've had using ExpressVPN, and it's been a positive one. You know, it was well over a year ago now when I started talking about them on the show, and I had never used their service before. I had used one VPN before that, wasn't happy with it. I started using ExpressVPN, and once I realized how easy it was to use and that it works exactly as advertised, I felt comfortable coming on here and telling all of you about it. If I had any issues using it, you wouldn't be hearing this right now, because there's no way I would be advertising it on my show. So secure your online activity today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. Use that link and get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Friday night, I did a SmackDown Rampage Super Show stream on YouTube. I don't usually combine the reviews for both shows. Typically, and it will get back to normal this Friday, but typically it's just a Rampage review, unless there is a big episode of SmackDown. And this week qualified as a big episode of SmackDown, because they were live from Madison Square Garden, their first time in MSG, I believe, in about 2 years. I did not go to the show. I had friends who went to the show who had a great time. And I thought that SmackDown this week was the best 2 hours of television the WWE has produced all year. I thought they knocked it out of the park and they had a hell of a fun show on Friday night. It was also the most frustrating 2 hours of television that they have produced all year, because it just shows that when they want to, and it does help to have a hot crowd like they had in New York, but when they want to, they can put on an entertaining show. And even if they can't all be the way that the MSG show was on Friday, you got 52 weeks a year. So that's 52 SmackDowns. That's 52 Raws. My God, 52 Raws. There's no excuse for them to not be able to put on shows that are more like the one that we saw on Friday. I would happily come on here every week with a smile on my face. Look at the smile I had on my face on Friday. You can actually see me on your screen if you watched it on YouTube. That was a hell of a show. The opening segment I thought was fantastic with Roman Reigns, Paul Heyman, Brock Lesnar. Brock in his ponytail back in MSG. He got a monster pop coming out. I thought everybody in that segment, the Usos were in the ring. They all played their role great. Lesnar really driving the drama by saying to Paul, "Paul, I have a question for you. How come you didn't tell Roman that I was going to be at SummerSlam?" And then Roman looking at Paul in this very distrustful way and yanking the championship away from him. And Paul's in the ring all by himself with Brock, and he decides, "I'm going to go back into advocate mode." And he's introducing Brock, and Brock is bouncing up and down like he used to do. And then he says, "You know, before Roman fires you, I want you to accept my challenge to a championship match with me against Roman Reigns." And when Paul didn't give him an answer in a timely fashion, he picked him up for an F5, and Roman Reigns saved Heyman. There was some physicality here. Roman basically ran over the Usos. He is now the ultimate babyface in this company. Brock Lesnar is the biggest babyface on any brand in WWE at the moment. I thought it was a hot opening segment. This is why I was excited to see Lesnar back at SummerSlam, even though it's a match that we've seen, it feels like, dozens of times before. I don't know if it's been dozens, but we have seen Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns one-on-one going back to WrestleMania 31 a whole bunch of times. And not even one-on-one. We've seen them in, you know, four ways and other types of matches. But the whole dynamic now has shifted. It has changed. The drama. Where does Paul Heyman stand? Where does his allegiance lie? When this is all over with and the dust settles, is he still going to be with Roman Reigns? Or are they going to reunite him with Brock Lesnar? That's the question. This is something they haven't done before. Heel Roman, babyface Brock. So I'm enjoying it so far. They did a 10-man tag on this show. Sami Zayn was on the heel side. He introduced Trae Young of the Atlanta Hawks as his invited guest in Madison Square Garden. He, of course, is one of the great villains of New York this year after helping to bounce the Knicks out of the playoffs. So people were ready to jump the railing and rip this guy to shreds. He looked like he was having a blast. I thought that was perfect. That, you talk about getting heel heat. Watching Sami Zayn, "I love New York," and introducing him. Big smile on his face. Sami Zayn, I thought, was just a fantastic asshole on that show on Friday night. They had a contract signing segment for Extreme Rules. Bianca Belair, Becky Lynch, they put pen to paper to make it official. Becky Lynch is out there doing her best Conor McGregor impersonation, which she has done before. She came out once on Raw to do commentary, dressed up looking like him. She had a crown on her head and everything. This time it was this giant red fur coat and the oversized sunglasses. And she was getting more boos than she's gotten in recent weeks. But, you know, it wasn't Trae Young heel heat. Let's just put it that way. I don't think anybody on that roster could get Trae Young heel heat in New York. But I still get the sense people really don't want to boo her. The jury is out whether or not this heel turn is going to work. I still think it's a terrible idea to take your, you know, top female babyface and turn her, but they're trying. They're trying to make it happen, and they're going to have their match at Extreme Rules. And then we had Edge against Seth Rollins. This was Edge Rollins 2. Their match at SummerSlam was the best match on the entire show. And so I was looking forward to seeing the rematch, and I was not disappointed. These two went out there and had a match that was on par with the match they had last month in Vegas. I don't know if it was better. It certainly wasn't worse. It was every bit as good. It was an excellent match. And I'm guessing it was the... And Rollins picked up the win this time. So now they're even at one win apiece. So I'm sure there'll be a third. But I'm guessing it was the Edge and Rollins match that went long. If anything, you know, went overly long on this show. It was probably the match, which is what led to the women's tag team match that was planned being cut. It was supposed to be Liv Morgan and Tony... And they never advertised this, but John Pollock of Post Wrestling confirmed that it was supposed to be Liv Morgan and Toni Storm against Carmella and Zelina Vega. Almost 25 minutes is what they gave that Rollins match, or at least that's how long they decided to go, which I think is great because I thought they had a fantastic match. But it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that match got cut. I don't blame WWE. They were live on TV. They're live on Fox. The show is running long. I feel bad for all four women, but I especially feel bad for Zelina Vega because she had gear, special gear made to pay tribute to her father who died in the 9/11 attacks. This was Madison Square Garden in New York on the 20th anniversary, the day before the 20th anniversary of the attacks in her hometown. And they had her doing press all week for this show. They used her to do press all week for this show, only for her match to get cut. But, you know, it wasn't some nefarious thing on WWE's part. It's just one of those things that happens sometimes. And it sucks for her. But I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to beat up on WWE for this because I'm sure that they were in a pinch. They had to make a decision on what gets cut. They weren't expecting the show to go long, but it did, and that's what happens sometimes. It's like when the women's match got cut from WrestleMania all those years ago, that was a really shitty thing, you know, that they did to them. And there are times where they'll have certain segments on a pay-per-view, they'll throw a talk show segment in there, and then some match gets cut, and it's like, what the fuck, right? Then you can blame WWE, because there are certain segments that you could say, well, did that really need to be on the show? It's like SummerSlam. When they did the Moist TV shit, and New Day came out and was spraying them with super soakers or whatever, if there was a match that got cut on that show, then by all means, beat up on WWE. Because there are segments like that that have no business being on a show like that. In this case, I don't think that it could have been helped. Usos and the Street Profits. I enjoyed their tag team title match in the main event. Cheap finish. Roman Reigns runs in, puts Montez Ford in the guillotine for the disqualification, and that brought out the Demon. We knew he was coming, the way that SmackDown ended the week before with that little, we saw the red light for a couple of seconds and that heartbeat sound, and we knew the Demon was coming. Finn Balor, all painted up as the Demon, came in to confront Roman and the Usos, and that's how they went off the air, and that's going to be the match at Extreme Rules. It's going to be Roman Reigns defending the championship against the Demon Balor. My criticism of the Demon, the demon persona, always had to do with the fact that there was never anything that really differentiated the way that Balor wrestled as himself from the way that he worked as the Demon character. The only thing that was different was the paint. There was nothing else about the way that he wrestled in those matches that was any different than any other Finn Balor match. And I always thought that he should have wrestled like a wild man as the Demon. Like, hardcore style. You remember the SmackDown segment many years ago where Mick Foley ripped off the Mankind shirt to reveal his Cactus Jack t-shirt? The look on Triple H's face when he did that. This was before their Royal Rumble match in 2000. Triple H sold that perfectly. He looked like he had seen a ghost. Because he knew that he was in for the fight of his life. As tough an opponent as Mankind could be, he was no Cactus Jack. The stories about Cactus Jack preceded him. He had this reputation as being this hardcore legend. You didn't want to mess with him. And I thought Triple H's facial expression just sold it perfectly. But that's the sort of thing I think that's missing from this demon stuff. I didn't see no shocked and scared look on Roman Reigns' face. He just stood there staring at this fucking guy wearing paint on his face and his chest. He didn't look scared to me. He didn't look intimidated to me. He didn't back away. That's the biggest issue I have with the demon stuff. You know, and even if he can't use weapons and plunder because it's not a no disqualification match, it doesn't have to be hardcore. I'm just saying he should be more aggressive in some way to differentiate the demon from just good old regular Finn Balor. Now, NXT, before I get into just some thoughts on the show this past week, we are heading into the reboot this Tuesday. They've been taped for the past 2 weeks while they upgrade the Capitol Wrestling Center. And so we're going to get to see what the new look of the building is like. Well, hopefully they got rid of the plexiglass stuff because I don't know that there's a need for that anymore. All the banging on the glass is kind of annoying. But first, Kushida. NXT Cruiserweight Champion Kushida, he revealed in an Instagram video this week that COVID-19 was the reason why his title defense against Roderick Strong never took place on TV a few weeks ago and why he has been missing. He said he tested positive 3 weeks ago. He and his wife are both fully vaccinated. They tested positive. They had very low energy and he lost his sense of smell and taste, but they're feeling better now. It was, I guess, relatively mild. And he should be back soon. So that's the update on Kushida, why we have not seen him on TV. I thought on NXT there was some real good in-ring action and entertaining bachelor and bachelorette party segments for Dexter Lumis and Indy Hartwell were the highlight of this week's show. The final show before their big wedding. The big Index wedding is coming up on Tuesday. Indy Hartwell's bachelorette party was hosted by Candice LeRae at some restaurant they never identified. Mackenzie Mitchell was there. Indy wanted her to interview her, but Mackenzie said that she left her microphone at home. She gets to take her microphone home with her. Interesting. Candice was trying to make a speech. Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter were fucking around on TikTok, so she yelled at them. She said, you know, I didn't approve of this relationship at first, but now I see how much you love each other. So all of a sudden, Candice is now on board with the wedding. Johnny Gargano, though, he's going to be a tough nut to crack as far as getting his approval. Indy said, well, I guess we'll have to crack Johnny's nut then, which got an awkward stare. Candice is like, I'm the only one who cracks Johnny's nut. Actually, that's exactly what happened because Candice LeRae is pregnant. For those who don't know, she is with child. She's doing TV as long as she physically can. At some point, though, she's going to have to come off. But I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, talking about Johnny's nut. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about Johnny's nut. I don't like where this new NXT is headed. So let's move on here. We don't need to be cracking anybody's nuts. She and Candice went off to spy on Dexter's bachelorette, or a bachelor party, I should say. And they left all of their guests at the restaurant, which seems like a really rude thing to do in the middle of a party, but off they went. Now, on the bachelor party side, they cut to Johnny Gargano, Dexter Lumis, Drake Maverick, Odyssey Jones, and a zombie referee, which is a nod to the match that Dexter and Cameron Grimes had. Might have been on the Halloween Havoc edition, actually, of NXT. So Johnny was adamant he's not paying for a dime of any of this. When all of a sudden Cameron Grimes met them at their destination, and he started doling out $100 bills to everybody like a father giving an allowance to his kids. He said he was paying for the whole thing. Don't worry about it. He shook hands with Dexter to make amends after months of feuding with him. Apparently, Grimes is no longer scared, I guess, of the zombie referee. They held the party at a giant arcade that had go-karts. They threw axes at a bullseye. They played laser tag. I was kind of jealous. I haven't been to an arcade like that in God. I'm trying to think. You know, if you remember the old hardcore title segments on television with Crash Holly, we talked about the best one. which is the one where he was at Funtime USA in Brooklyn, going down the super slide, trying to get away from the headbangers, right, through the ball pit. That might have been the last place like that that I ever went to, was Funtime USA. And Funtime, I mean, God, that it's probably been gone for 15 years now. It's a fucking storage facility now. So, brought me back to my Funtime days. I kind of miss that. I got to find out where the local arcade is, where I can do some laser tag and some go-karts. Sure, they must have something in the city. But Indy and Candace were shown spying on them throughout all of this. Johnny won the go-kart race, and then Dexter showed him how to properly throw the axe. Dexter helped him get a bunch of kills in laser tag by sneaking up behind members of the civilian team and choking them unconscious. There was also a scene where Drake Maverick was bouncing on the trampoline and Odyssey Jones, who is well over 300 pounds, wanted in on the fun, and he bounced Maverick up into the air because Drake is, if he's 170 pounds, soaking wet, I'd be shocked. And so he went flying. By the end of this, Johnny was pretty happy, and Indy jumped out and said they had successfully busted Johnny's nut, cracked Johnny's nut, and Gargano finally gave his approval on their nuptials, so the wedding is on for this Tuesday. We are all cordially invited to the wedding of Dexter Lumis and Indy Hartwell. You know, wrestling weddings are almost always good to pop a number. I don't know what would be considered a really good number for NXT these days. Maybe 800,000 overall would be considered pretty good. Some people are going to think this was all just way too goofy and it's not for them. It was goofy. But it was goofy in a good way. I enjoyed this. Kaylee Ray defeated Ember Moon. I thought they had a very good match. Moon was the perfect opponent for her to beat because she's a credible name who could go in there and give her a good match. Later in the show, Ember acknowledged that she's been in a funk since losing the NXT Women's Tag Team titles, and she lost her partner as well, right? Shotzi Blackheart now is on SmackDown. She hasn't won a match recently. She knows now what she has to do, and she told us to stay tuned. So maybe a more aggressive Ember Moon is coming. A change would not be a bad idea for her right now. Santos Escobar pinned Carmelo Hayes, the 2021 breakout tournament winner. With a little help from Electra Lopez on the outside, she pulled a China. She slammed Hayes on the floor. Back inside, Escobar hit the Phantom Driver for the win. They did a cool spot here where Escobar put Hayes in a lion tamer on the ring steps. I thought that was unique. But Hayes hung in there with him. Escobar is the one being pushed, though, and I like adding a female flavor to Legado del Fantasma. Now we got to get her in the ring with B-Fab. I'm waiting to see B-Fab get in the ring. We got to see the Creed brothers in action for the first time. Julius and Brutus. Good grief. Someone has been reading up on the assassination of Julius Caesar, I see. They're the newest additions to Diamond Mine. They're two brothers who both signed with WWE last October. They were both amateur wrestlers in college, which would explain their wrestling in amateur gear here in this match. They won a quick squash and looked really good in the short amount of time they were out there. It's like they just told these two, go out there and just stiff the shit out of your opponents. It's one of those matches where you kind of go up to your opponents in the back and you apologize in advance. I think Eddie Guerrero, the story with Eddie Guerrero, he had a match on SmackDown many years ago, and I don't remember if it was against Roderick Strong or Jimmy, I want to say Jimmy Jacobs. Might have been a match with Jimmy Jacobs where whatever the storyline they were doing with Eddie at the time, he was going to go out there and beat the piss out of this guy. And I think he actually apologized or warned him in the back, like, look, it's going to be a little rough out there. And it was. I kind of feel like the Creed brothers might have done the same thing here with these two poor guys. But they went out there and they beat the hell out of them. And I have to say, you know, this is the most impressed I've been so far with Diamond Mine. I think this is the perfect group for them to be part of with Malcolm Bivens as their mouthpiece. Io Shirai and Zoe Starks retain the NXT Women's Tag Team titles over Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter. Shirai won it with the moonsault on Kat and Zara for the win. There was a spot where Zoe Stark accidentally knocked Io off the apron. So they're planting seeds of a breakup already. After the match, Mandy Rose, Gigi Dolin, and JC Jane attacked Kat and Zara and Carter. Mandy stole Sheamus' face mask, apparently, after Saray drop-kicked her in the face the week before. They're doing the same gimmick on both shows. It's like the same mask. As far as I know, Mandy was not legitimately injured by Saray. Why would you cover up a face like that? Unless it was a legitimate injury, which, again, this wasn't. Why would you cover up a face like that? Mandy Rose is a beautiful woman. And they put a mask on her. Only these people would have Otis shave his face so we could see it up close in full HD, but put a mask on Mandy Rose. We finally saw the in-ring debut of Mei Ying of Tian Sha with Boa in her corner. Still no Xia Li. She made short work of Virginia Ferry. I think I rode that once. The Ferry, that is. She won with the Tongan Death Grip and took Virginia to the mat. She took Virginia down south and pinned her shoulders down for three. This story was fun, I thought, to follow for the first several weeks, but it's lost a lot of steam since. It's almost like they don't know what to do. They don't know where to go with this. And if this is how Karen Q is going to wrestle all of her matches, then this is going to get old real fast. MSK retained their tag team titles in the main event over Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. Pete Dunne gave Ridge Holland a little nod after the match, which was his signal to beat up Lorcan and Burch. Their faction is no more. They have gone from a foursome down to a duo. Now this Tuesday is a big night for NXT. They're back live after 2 weeks off. We have the wedding. We have a fatal four-way to determine Samoa Joe's first challenger. From either Pete Dunne, Tommaso Ciampa, Kyle O'Reilly, or LA Knight. I am expecting a Pete Dunne win. And Raquel Gonzalez defends her NXT Women's Championship against Frankie Monet. So that's coming up on Tuesday. Now, in the absence of This Week in Wrestling History, which finished up last week, for those who may have missed it, all of those segments are archived in a lovely playlist for you on the YouTube channel, for those of you who ever want to go back, and if you missed one, or you want to refer back to it for research purposes, they're all there for you, all in order. But what it's going to allow me to start doing again is reviving the mailbag and taking some of your questions, and we'll take a few here this week. But if you have questions to send in, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the email address. Please include your name and where you are from, or else I may not use your question on the air. Neil, from Chicago, do you think AEW is building towards a blood and guts match between the Elite and the team of Bryan Danielson, Jungle Boy, Luchasaurus, Christian Cage, and a returning Hangman Page? If so, should this be the main event of Full Gear? I believe this would also mark 5 straight years that Adam Cole has been in a War Games match, if this does happen. I could envision that as an 8-man tag or a 10-man tag, but not a blood and guts match. They already did one. Not that long ago. It was only in May, right? Cinco de Mayo, we had a blood and guts match. Now, I don't know if to them, it's going to be an annual thing. I mean, they could always, you know, bust out the blood and guts gimmick when there's a reason to. Kind of the way Hell in a Cell used to be many years ago. But I think it would be too much. I think it would be overkill to do 2 blood and guts matches this year. So no, I don't see that as being blood and guts, no, but a 10-man tag, yeah, I think that's very possible. Jad from London, and by the way, I would not do that as the main event of Full Gear. They only have 4 pay-per-views each year. Your main event should be an AEW championship match. You can save the tag team matches for television. I would not do that as the main event of Full Gear. Jad from London, England. I'd like to get your thoughts on Pat McAfee as a commentator. When he was managing Oney Lorcan, Danny Burch, and Pete Dunne on NXT, I thought he was one of the best characters on the show. but as a commentator on SmackDown, I find him to be fucking insufferable and one of the absolute worst characters on the show. I don't think he does or says anything to get anybody else over. He is a loudmouth, obnoxious prick. Wow. Which doesn't serve commentating well, in my opinion, and don't get me started on the dancing on the announce table when Nakamura and Rick Boogs come out. I can't stand it. It hurts my ears and it grates my eyes. In this capacity, I think he adds nothing to the product, and if anything, he takes away from it. What do you think? Jad, I'm going to have to disagree with you on this hard. I actually think he's done a tremendous job on commentary. And one of the reasons that Pat McAfee has been such a delight for me on SmackDown is that you can tell the effect that he has had on Michael Cole. Michael Cole has changed since Pat McAfee joined him on the commentary team. He is more animated when there is a big moment. You just look back at SummerSlam as one example when Brock Lesnar came out. In any other circumstance, Michael Cole would go, "Oh my," right? That's his signature call, "Oh my." But now, when John Cena came back, he lost his mind. He was marking out. When Brock Lesnar came out at SummerSlam, also marking out, losing his mind. I don't think that happens without Pat McAfee. I think Pat McAfee has driven Michael Cole to kind of change his shtick a little bit. He's probably made it more fun for him. When we get the occasional glance in the background of the announcers, you can see Cole laughing. Like, he's having a great time out there. So I actually think Pat McAfee has helped elevate Michael Cole's game. Can McAfee be a little over the top? Yes. There are moments where he can be annoying, but I don't find him annoying and grating in the same way that, for example, I find Chris Jericho to be. When Chris Jericho gets animated on Rampage, I find him to be incredibly annoying. I don't feel the same way about Pat McAfee. I actually think he's done a very good job. In a very short period of time, I think he does a very good job. And he clearly does not get on my nerves the way that he does yours. But when they show him, like, you see him standing in the background, like, when there's a really exciting moment, you'll see him, he stands, right? Even though Michael Cole is sitting, there's Pat McAfee, he's standing, because he's a fan. And that enthusiasm, that's not manufactured by Vince McMahon. I think that's maybe the other big thing about Pat McAfee. I don't get the sense, while I'm sure he might be getting direction in his ear, you know, on certain things to say by Vince McMahon, I don't get the sense that he's being phony. That's the one thing that I absolutely cannot stand about a lot of their announcers, whether it's Byron Saxton, Corey Graves, or whoever else it may have been over the years. There are times you can clearly tell, even Cole, there are times where you can clearly tell these people are being phony as shit. I don't like the blatant phoniness on the announcing. These people need to have credibility. I need to believe in what they're saying. They're the soundtrack of these shows. Jim Ross always had credibility because you believed his emotion was genuine, even if he was being over the top with it. Stone cold, you know, by God. That's just Jim Ross being Jim Ross. Triple H would do something dastardly. You bastard, you'll burn in hell. Like, he was fucking great, right? Because it just felt genuine. So if we can get even a little bit of that, if that's what Pat McAfee does to help bring that out of Michael Cole, and if he brings that to the table himself, then you've already elevated the commentary game on your show. So I enjoy it. You are going to have a difference of opinion here because I think you're way off on this. But to each their own. I mean, look, if he hurts your ears, then he hurts your ears. But I don't have an issue with Pat McAfee. Steno from Salt Lake City, Utah. I've heard people refer to the Ultimate Warrior versus Goldberg as a dream match. I wanted to know your thoughts. My personal opinion is that it's about as much of a dream match as Giant Gonzalez against the Great Khali would be. I don't know who these people are that you speak of. If you are following these people on social media, you need to unfollow them immediately. That sounds like a nightmare, not a dream. I mean, as an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old, 25 years ago, it would have sounded cool on paper. Goldberg against the Warrior, but even in their physical primes, that sounds like a total disaster waiting to happen. That's like the blind leading the blind. Michael from Liverpool, England. First of all, I thought your tribute to Daphne on last week's show did her proud. Very heartfelt. Thank you. I got some nice feedback. I'm happy that people enjoyed it. Hopefully I covered it in a good way and covered all the important stuff, but thank you. My question is, when wrestling fans discuss potential dream matches we never got to see, one that I never see mentioned is Chris Benoit against Ken Shamrock. Both had an intense... you could say that. Both had an intense shoot style with signature submission moves, which could lead to a great series of matches had the two of them feuded. Just wondered what your thoughts were. I had never thought about Benoit against Shamrock. They kind of just missed each other, right? Because 2000, I think, was the year Shamrock left. Benoit had just come in, so they did share some time on the same roster for a few months, and then Shamrock was gone not long after that. Yeah, I think they could have had a pretty good match. I don't look at it as a dream match. You know, I think that word gets bastardized and thrown around way too much. Oh, this is a dream match. This is a dream match. There aren't that many realistic dream matches that I have in my mind. When I think back to dream matches that could have been and weren't, you know, you could come up with a whole bunch of them. I wouldn't say Shamrock and Benoit is one that would be on my list. I think it would have been a good match. I wouldn't call it a dream match. You know, for me, the ultimate dream match would have been, you know, in their prime, Kurt Angle against Bret Hart. I think that would have been just fucking fantastic. And I've even thought of tag team wise, Bret and Owen, like mid-90s Bret and Owen against 2002 Angle Benoit when they were doing the tag team thing and they actually were the tag team champions on SmackDown. You take Bret and Owen from that era, Angle and Benoit from that era, you put them together in a tag team match, you could headline any pay-per-view with that. But you mentioned Shamrock, I'll throw one at you. If anything, I look at this more as a dream match than I do Shamrock and Benoit, is Shamrock and Angle. I mean, that would have been an obvious match to do, right? The Battle of the Ankle Locks. Kurt Angle and Ken Shamrock, I think, would have been a hell of a match. But I still think that word dream gets thrown around more than it should. And Frank from Canyon, Texas. Did you ever attend any ECW shows at the ECW Arena during the 90s? I did not. I think I would have been terrified. If I were older, then I absolutely would have gone. But for younger me who, you know, didn't really know any better, and I wasn't following the ECW product weekly. I wasn't watching the weekly show. I was aware of them. I knew who the big names were. And I had seen, you know, some matches and stuff, but it had a reputation that I think I would have been scared. I literally would have been scared to go to a lot of those shows. But having not been there, I didn't know any better. So no, I didn't get the chance to go. I'm still kicking myself for not going to that first one night stand. That's one of my biggest regrets. Right in my backyard. I've been to that building since then so many times. I started going to that building like a year or two after that for Ring of Honor shows, and I had a blast. I would have loved to have been in the building for that first one-night stand pay-per-view. But no, I never went to any of the original ECW shows back in the 90s. Yesterday marked the 20-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And if any of you find any of this upsetting, just a warning, you can skip ahead or you can switch off. WWE put out a half-hour documentary called Never Forget, which documents their running the first large-scale event of its kind in the country 2 days after the attacks. You're not going to learn anything new from it, but it's still pretty powerful to reflect back on that whole week from the perspective of the folks who worked for the company at that time. At least they left out Stephanie's comments, comparing almost 3,000 people losing their lives to the government putting her father on trial for steroid distribution. Somehow that didn't make the documentary, which is good. But you see Stone Cold and other stars who were there, you know, getting emotional, talking about how they learned about the attacks, Lillian Garcia talking about being on the phone with one of her friends downtown when the line suddenly went dead and one of the buildings collapsed. Her singing the national anthem on that show and crying right after. I think a lot of us were crying after that. Edge. He admits that he was of the mind that we shouldn't be doing this. We should be home with our families. So there were conflicting feelings, even from the people who worked in the company, about whether or not they should be doing that show. Others thought that, you know what, it would be a good idea to go out there and entertain and take people's minds off of what happened, even if just for a couple of hours. And to the fans who were in the building that night, it did mean something for them to be there. There are fans who were in the building in Houston that night who said it's I don't know if favorite is the right word, but it's the show that sticks with them, and it's an experience that they will never forget for the rest of their lives, being in the building that night, just 48 hours removed from the worst attack on American soil in the history of this country. So it is a night that a lot of people, for various reasons, will remember for a very long time to come. It's a little over 30 minutes. It's not a long watch. They are self-indulgent in moments and stuff. I know that's a turnoff for some people, but on the whole, I thought it was a very well done, you know, well put together short documentary. I was in college when the attacks happened. I was out on Long Island. I was in my dorm room. And I had just come out of the shower, actually, and I had Good Morning America on. I had left it on the TV because that's what I used to watch back then in the morning. And on my TV, I saw one of the towers with smoke billowing out of it. And they explained what had happened. And at first, you think, boy, you know, this guy, this pilot, he must have been way off course to crash into a big building like that. Like, how do you not, of all the buildings to crash into, how do you not see that coming? And then the second plane hit. And when that happened, everybody knew what was going on. So I think even the people who maybe were already kind of thinking, well, wait a minute, maybe this is, you know, an attack or it was a hijacked plane or something. And I don't think a lot of people had that thought in their mind after the first one. But by the time the second one hit, I don't think there was any doubt in anyone's mind what was going on here. And that's when things got very scary. And I remember calling my mother to see if she was watching what was going on. And I got dressed. I went to go to class. And I didn't even get into the lobby of the building before I could see a small crowd of people had congregated just inside. They were looking up at the TV that was on the wall. And everybody was just transfixed on the television. And then the first building came down. And I honestly don't even remember what I did after that. I don't remember if I went back to my room or if I just sort of wandered around campus. It's kind of a blur. I don't remember. I know I never made it to class because classes were canceled for the day. So maybe that's what happened. I might have actually gone to class, sat there. In fact, you know what? That's exactly what happened. Now, it's all coming back to me now. I went to class. I had an English class. I think it was like English Lit. And I remember sitting down. And the teacher came in eventually and said he was a basket case because he knew someone who was down there. And obviously he wasn't able to get in touch with them. So you could see how frenzied he was. And that's when he said, you know, classes are canceled. And I remember that because when I reached back out to him, Professor Brand, I reached back out to him a number of years ago, probably about 10 years ago. I hadn't talked to him in so long. And he was one of the good ones, so I wanted to keep in touch with him and find out how he was doing and everything. And he remembered me, which I was shocked by. And one of the reasons that he remembered me was the fact that I was in the room when he had rushed in and kind of told everybody that classes were canceled. So that stuck out even in his mind. And then, sadly, a few years after that, he passed away. But everything else that day for me is sort of a blur. I mean, it's just a surreal experience. I was inside the World Trade Center the year before for an awards ceremony. I had won a scholarship from the New York City Lottery. It was called the Leaders of Tomorrow. That's what it was called. And they had this big ceremony. And I, for all the years I've lived in New York, I've never actually been to the World Trade Center. I've been to the Empire State Building, but I had never been physically in either of the towers before. And it just so happened that, you know, the year before I was there, and I can remember being downtown, standing right at the base of both of these towers, and I remember just looking up and thinking how freaking high it was. And the thought of it, to me, not being there anymore, these two giant buildings that I had just literally been standing at the base of, looking up at, a year earlier, the idea that they're not there anymore, it was just beyond my comprehension. The thought of it falling or imploding with people still inside, it's the most horrifying thing that I've ever seen, you know, play out on television. I can't imagine what it would have been like to see it playing out physically, being there on the ground, running away, or living in a building, you know, a couple of blocks away. You know, to see the images of those people trapped inside that building, so desperate, jumping out of windows, jumping to their death, is something I'll never be able to get out of my head. And I had a close cousin who was supposed to be in one of the towers that day, but he had called out sick. So, fortunately, I personally didn't know anybody who was in either building when they went down, although there was someone I was friendly with online at that time. I used to talk wrestling. It was an old wrestling message board that doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, this was 2001. I know that he died in one of the towers because he disappeared online for a few weeks and nobody knew where he was. And then somebody who I guess knew him or somehow found out that he was in one of the towers and he had passed away. And that was sort of the closest connection that I had to any specific person that would have been in either building. I knew more people who frankly might have been there that day, but thankfully didn't go for whatever reason. Just dumb luck, fate, illness, whatever it was. And, you know, I think it was Edge in the WWE documentary who used the words post-apocalyptic to describe what the streets look like in Texas. And they were in Texas for SmackDown that week because there was no traffic. You know, there was air traffic was suspended. There was no traffic on the street. There were no cars. There were no people. Post-apocalyptic is what it looked like in downtown New York City, with smoke everywhere, people walking around covered in debris. It looked like a bomb went off. It looked like something out of a disaster movie. Only this was no movie. This was real life. It was a horrible, horrible thing that happened that day. And a lot of first responders and people who lived down there got sick after that and died. They're still getting sick today and dying from breathing in all of that debris. Who knows how many cancer-causing chemicals were floating around in the area for months, maybe years after that. And people still went down there and they helped try to dig out and try to rebuild. People were, you know, you see them in the footage and everything, and I don't go back and watch it too often because it's just too upsetting, but you see people literally running for their lives at these plumes of smoke and debris chasing after them like some kind of monster. And I don't want to ignore the Pentagon and the plane also that went down in Pennsylvania because people lost their lives there as well. A lot of people did that day, not counting the scumbags who did this. And 20 years later, we haven't forgotten that. If you have never visited the 9/11 memorial, if you are ever in New York, make the time to go downtown and visit it. It's powerful, powerful stuff to stand there in the middle of all of that, where those two buildings used to be, and think about what happened there, and to see the new tower in its place. You know, years from now, people are going to read about it in textbooks, or they're going to read about it only on Wikipedia. They weren't even born yet. Some of you listening to this right now probably weren't even born when all of this happened, everything I'm describing. And because they didn't live through it, to them, it's just going to be words on a page. But for all of the people who did live through that period and the aftermath of it, which is still being felt today, it's something that we'll never forget. I had never lived to experience anything in my life up to that point that changed the world the way that that one day changed the entire world. And it did, whether it's air travel, the wars that followed. It didn't just change this country. It changed the world. For better or worse, it changed the world. And now I feel like I've lived through a few different events like that just in the last 5 years. And we're still going through one of them right now as we speak. But anyway, I just wanted to take a few minutes just to talk about that and my experience that day. And it seems like the world has only gotten crazier since then. And it's nice to have something like pro wrestling, as inconsequential as it may be in the grand scheme of things, to talk about. And to tune out all of the other bullshit going on around us, even if it's only for a few hours each week. And it's one of the reasons I always say, be well and stay safe at the end of every show that I do, because you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. Take nothing for granted. Here today, gone tomorrow. Enjoy what you have. Because if you can't enjoy that, then what the hell is the point of any of this? Again, email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. If you have questions, if you have comments, suggestions, anything like that, that is the place to reach out. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, on Instagram, @TheSolomonster. This Thursday, Dark Side of the Ring Season 3, Part 2. The second half of Season 3 is back on Vice. They are kicking things off with the episode on the plane ride from hell, is going to be very interesting. And I also think not very kind to Ric Flair, would be my guess. Probably not kind to a lot of people, Flair included. I will be resuming my reviews. The plan is to do a review that goes up probably, maybe not the next day, but in the days after on YouTube. And then I'll probably pull the audio as well and push it out to the feed. So I think we'll work it exactly the way we did earlier this year. But yes, the reviews are coming back. So we'll be covering all of the Dark Side of the Ring stuff, and we will be back next Sunday for a episode of the podcast as we do each and every week. That'll be episode 722. We have some big shows coming up this month, including the Arthur Ashe New York City debut for AEW. Over 18,000 people are going to be in that building. We had a big U.S. Open tennis match yesterday inside. It's a beautiful-looking stadium that will now be corrupted by wrestling fans. We are going to corrupt Arthur Ashe Stadium in a few weeks. And there'll be a big review stream. I will not be at the show, so as soon as it goes off the air, I will be able to go live on YouTube. And then, of course, Extreme Rules coming up later this month as well. So thank you for all the support on the channel, by the way. We had our biggest month ever in August, and so far we're doing pretty good in September. We just passed 65,000 subscribers on the channel on Friday night. And that could not happen without your support. So I thank you for that. Thank you for getting me to 65K. Now we look to 70 and then 75 and onward and upward to bigger and better things. So be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. And join me again for 722 coming up next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Everybody is freaking out about the new NXT logo. It looks like something out of a cartoon. Yes, it sucks. I am more concerned about the future of that NXT show, what it is going to look like 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now. It is a logo. Who gives a shit? They're talking about completely revamping the brand and the way they recruit talent, and people are freaking out about the fucking logo. Are you people for real? Who cares?
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.